So I'm going to pick up from where we were during the first lecture, but I don't want the people who weren't here during at the first lecture to be lost from the get-go. So I will review, I'll try and bring us up to speed, and if anything is unclear because you missed the first lecture, please ask me. So I guess for you it was two lectures ago, for me one lecture ago. One lecture ago in terms of Kabbalah. Last time we spoke, remember we mapped out the various phases of Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah, and we said that Kabbalah is one subset of Jewish mysticism. Remember, what did we say defines Kabbalah as Kabbalah? Now that it's a small group, you really all have to speak. Okay, we said that the central characteristic of Kabbalah is the notion of the Sfirot. So Jewish mystical texts before the 12th century don't have this conception of the Sfirot. And so scholars date the beginning of Kabbalah to the 12th century, and we said the first work of Kabbalah that we have as of yet is Sefer HaBahir, which was written by Isaac the Blind, and it appears in, Sefer HaBahir, which is anonymous, which is from the school of Isaac the Blind, and it appears in Provence. Okay. So, last time we mapped out the various phases, and then we, at the very end of the lecture, we started to talk about the major ideas, and remind me your name? David already put in a request that we zoom in and focus on the ideas, and that's what we will do today. So we said that the one defining characteristic of Kabbalah is this notion of the Sfirot. But we actually, when we spoke about it, we said that the Kabbalistic conception of God is more complicated. And we said that the Sfirot is the aspect that people usually talk about and remember because it's the sort of the sexier part of the God of the Kabbalist conception of God. But there's also another aspect to the Kabbalist conception of God, and that was that's part of the Sfirot. So now we're talking about something that's separate from the Sfirot. We have you here in the front, the Ein Sof. So we talked about the Kabbalist dualistic but there are two aspects to God for the Kabbalist. There's the unknowable Ein Sof, and then there is the knowable part of God, the Sfirot. And before I even speak a little bit more about this, and then we're going to read a text or two talking about these two aspects, and then David, I promise, we will get to the individual Sfirot, and we will look at a Zoharic piece on the individual Sfirot. But just to, I think to do this justice, if you went to a more popular class on Kabbalah, I think they would just focus on the Sfirot, and that really is only part of the story. First of all, the Kabbalists refer to this conception of God as Sod HaElokut. This is the secret of God. And this is one of the main aspects of Kabbalah. The Kabbalists spend still a lot of ink talking about the nature of God. But when they speak about the nature of God, they're primarily speaking about the Sfirot. And that's why the Sfirot is the part of God that comes to mind at first. They hardly ever speak about the Ein Sof. And why is that? Who remembers? What did we say is the nature of the Ein Sof, according to the Kabbalists?
Unknowable.
Okay, the Ein Sof is the infinite. It's unknowable. It's the infinite part of God. It's transcendent. In many ways, we spoke about this last time, it reflects the God of the philosophers. And that's not completely coincidental. Remind me your name?
Barbara.
It's not completely coincidental because many of the Kabbalists were influenced by the philosophers and thought that there was a lot of truth to what the philosophers did, but there were certain limits. And you'll see the Kabbalistic system solve certain problems that Jewish philosophers encounter. And then, of course, it creates new problems, new theological problems. The Kabbalists very much appropriate philosophical ideas and then, as we said, add on to them and twist them in ways that the philosophers would find very disturbing, if not heretical. So there is a chasm between these two groups, but they do use, especially the Kabbalists, use the terms of the philosophers. So again, the Ein Sof is the infinite part of God. It's the perfect part of God. It's the part of God that doesn't change. And the Kabbalists often speak about, they usually don't speak about the Ein Sof, but when they do speak about the Ein Sof, they often use the Maimonidean term, concept of the negative attributes. That the only thing that one can say about God is what God isn't. Right? So one can say is that God is not kind, right? God is not vengeful, right? But we can't, due to the limits of human reason and due to the limits of language, we can't know anything positive about God. We can only know something. We can only say, well, God is not. And so even the name, the Ein Sof, we know that God is without end. We don't really have anything positive to any content to add to that description.
Well, if they're saying that God is infinite, isn't that positive?
God is infinite. Well, that is the one thing they are saying, and infinity is something, right, that's hard to grasp. It's something by definition, it has no limits,
not a negative, it's a positive.
No, negative not in the sense of it being a bad thing. Not a negative in the sense that sort of think of negative space, that the term, right? Negative space isn't a bad thing. Negative space is the absence of, well, in art, right? The absence of any color, picture, concept. So here, negative meaning negative in terms of content, and vis-a-vis humans. Human reason does not allow one to penetrate anything and to understand anything about the Ein Sof.
In Hebrew, it is negative. And
right. In Hebrew, it is negative, but the Kabbalists also do have this notion.
In English, it's negative also.
Infinity.
Infinite means not final.
Right.
Isn't that what it means?
Okay. So so when we see our spherotic diagram for the Kabbalists, this is only one aspect of God. This is the aspect of God that is knowable, that is not infinite, that is revealed. We'll talk about the spherot in a few minutes. Before we even talk about the individual spherot, I just want to make sure that we all are on the same page, or not on the same page.
What's the word, if you know what mean? I mean, the linguistic definition of sefirot or sefirah.
Right. Well, it's unclear. People don't know exactly what it means. Some conjecture that it comes from the word mispar, from the word number. Mm-hmm. And the term sefirot, sphere, also appears, but here I might confuse you, so be ready to be confused. This is a little more subtle. The word sefirah already appears in Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, which I said last time is the earliest Hebrew systematic mystical treatise, but it's not a Kabbalistic treatise. Why isn't it a Kabbalistic treatise? Because it doesn't have a conception of the sefirot. So there it seems that the term sefirah really denotes numbers. And not, for the Kabbalists, the Sefirot are 10 aspects, 10 potencies of God. And that you first find in Sefer Habahir. So I can't tell you the origin of the term Sefirot, but I can tell you what it means for the Kabbalists.
The word Sefirot.
First of all, they could have used
a better, more descriptive term.
Right. They don't always use the term sefirot. They often use the term midot, which also doesn't work completely because midot means attribute, and the sefirot are not quite attributes. They're part of God's essence. The Kabbalists use various terms. They often use the terms crowns, they often speak about the spheros as a body, but you're right. I mean, and by the way, the Kabbalists are very subtle with their use of language, and they're aware of the deficiency of almost all of these terms, and they don't stick too closely. They don't use any one term exclusively because of this. And so you'll see if when we talk about the sphero, we're going to have, well, hundreds of symbols associated with each of the spheros and with the spherot as a whole. We're just going to highlight the major symbols so that we can read basic text. But the Kabbalists are aware of the limitations. They don't want you to think that the spherot are numbers. And so therefore they're also called nidot.
Sphirot is not related to the English word sphere.
It could be. Again, no one knows the exact origin of this term. Yes.
Are the spherot related to the planets, physical planets?
No. Especially Malchut is in some texts associated with Saturn, but not.
Where did the concept of spherot come from, looking at planets?
No. The spherot are part of God. They're not planets.
But the origin, and we had someone think of...
Or does the sun have a planet associated with it?
Right, no. Again, we don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Kabbalists don't... The earliest systematic treatise that we have that deals with the doctrine of the spherot is a work by Azriel of Gerona. And if I can ask you to tell your story.
What century was that?
Azriel of Gerona is in the 13th century. And he doesn't talk about the origin of the terms. He's more interested in the concept. So unfortunately, we don't know. If you want to do some research into it, there's still some work to be done. Okay. So before we even talk about the spherot, I just want to highlight how daring what I just said is, and not even what I just said is, but what the Kabbalists have said. All of a sudden we are talking about, right, this is Judaism, which you mentioned last time, right, this is a monotheistic religion, right, every day, right, Jews say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, there's one God, and now all of a sudden we're talking about a God that has two aspects. A revealed aspect and a concealed aspect. And we'll see the Kabbalists are very much aware of the fact that this is dangerous and this is veering towards dualism. And again, some academic scholars assert that Kabbalah was very much influenced in its infancy by Gnosticism. Jewish mysticism was influenced by Gnosticism, this notion that there are two gods out there, and even non-academic scholars, even later mystics, admitted that they were influenced by certain Gnostical notions, even though they obviously didn't take it to the degree that the Gnostics do. So what I wanted to do is just to highlight how daring these ideas are and how much the Kabbalists themselves were aware of it. I thought we'd look at two texts. And then we'll talk about the spherot. So the first text that we were going to... Oh, I also had a beautiful text. You know, maybe we'll do this text very, very fast. I'm just looking at the... No, you know, we won't have time. There's a beautiful text, How to Approach the Kabbalah, which really, if we have time at the end, maybe we'll finish with this. But last time I spent a lot of time talking about how Kabbalah was studied traditionally and what the problem with popular study of Kabbalah is. And so I just wanted you to see a traditional, very important Kabbalist, Moses Cordovero, his words of advice on how one should begin to study Kabbalah. And I thought that would be a nice introduction for us before we start to study ideas.
Concealed, revealed. Would that be related to the unknowable and the knowable?
Okay.
Revealed would be the knowable?
Yes.
Oh.
Okay. So we're going to start with the text that we started to read last time, but we ran through it at the end, and that was Moses Cordovero's piece, Water, Light, and Colors. Actually, no, maybe... You know, maybe we can do this after. Why don't we? We're going to move to Cordovero's next piece. Moses Cordovero's Shiur Koma Non-Duality. Just to remind you, and for those of you who weren't here last time, when we mapped out the different stages of Kabbalah, we said that one of the most creative periods of Kabbalah took place in Tzfat in the 16th century. And many of you are familiar with the greats who lived in Tzfat. And two of the greats, one of the greats is the Ari, Rabbi Isaac Luria, who wrote, or whose students recorded his teachings in the Eitz Chaim. And the second incredibly important Kabbalist who lived in Tzfat is Moses Cordovero, and somehow he's also referred to often by his acronym, the Ramak. Somehow Cordovero, I think, doesn't get his fair share, and one reason is that he's very much overshadowed by his student, Isaac Luria. Isaac Luria's Kabbalah is very mythical, incredibly daring, makes a lot of use of sexual symbolism, and therefore Luria's Kabbalah became incredibly popular, and a lot of the myths became important in Jewish culture. Cordovero is more philosophical in his orientation, and maybe because of that he didn't get as much time as Luria did, but is a very important Kabbalist. And one of his major contributions is he lived in the 16th century, and he synthesized many of the earlier mystical traditions. His most important work is the Pardes Rimonim, and so we had a piece from the Pardes Rimonim on the previous page, and hopefully we'll get to it at the end. But he wrote many works, and many of his works are also commentaries on the Zohar. So we will read one piece by Cordovero right now, Non-Duality. Who would like to read? What's your name in the...
Sonia.
Can you read?
The essence of divinity is found in every single thing. Nothing but it exists. Since it causes everything to be, no thing can live by anything else. It enlivens them. Its existence exists in each existence. Do not attribute duality to God. Let God be solely God. If you suppose that Ein Sof emanates until a certain point, and that from that point on is outside of it, you have dualized. God forbid, realize, rather, that Ein Sof exists in each existence. Do not say, this is a stone and not God. God forbid. Rather, all existence is God, and the stone is a thing pervaded by divinity.
Okay, this is a very beautiful piece, but a difficult piece. What's he saying here? The essence of divinity is found in every single thing. Now let's start also the second paragraph. Do not attribute duality to God. Let God be solely God. If you suppose that Ein Sof emanates until a certain point, and from that point on is outside of it, you have dualized, God forbid.
If you think that God is not if you think that he has an end point, then there are things that can't be God.
Everything is God.
Okay, so we have to be careful. He's getting close to saying that. And by the way, as I said last time, you can't really speak about the Kabbalists, just as you can't speak about the philosophers. So on this issue, Cordovero is somewhat more extreme than other Kabbalists, but he is dealing with an issue that all Kabbalists deal with, and an issue that we are soon going to deal with when we discuss the transition from the Ein Sof to the Sefirot, so I want you to be aware of it.
Can I say, what do you refer to when you say the philosophers?
Oh, I'm saying one can't. That was my point.
No, but
one can't. I'm saying that was my point. Mm-hmm. I don't, right? They're different philosophers, right?
Because
they're
Greek.
I'm saying in general, within Judaism, in general. Mm-hmm. One can't speak, right?
Because
that's,
you said
that's
my
the point.
With the philosophers, I was wondering if you meant.
Right. Well, right. So just as, and that's the tricky point, which you're, just as one can't speak about, right, the Kabbalists and their different Kabbalistic schools and streams, there are certain concepts and ideas that do define the Kabbalists and are common to all Kabbalists, as is the case with the philosophers, at least in the Middle Ages. So here we're coming to a point that at least all of the Kabbalists have to deal with. So you got pretty close.
I think I was thinking that if you think that God is not infinite, and he ends at a certain point, then you could say that this rock is not God. And then you're
okay. So you got half of it, right? So one has to say that God is infinite, because if you don't say that God is infinite, then there'll be another power, right? Equal to God, or also.
Why does the rock have to be equal to God? It's just a creation. Why does that create duality? It's God's creation.
Right. Because the Kabbalists are working with the system of emanation. This is based on Neoplatonic ideas in which even creation is formed by an attenuated aspect of the original source. So that's how something is created. It can't be completely separate. That's what he's saying here.
But that's a traditional thought, that even an inanimate object is a creation of God. That's a traditional Jewish thought.
But no,
creation
doesn't
have to be God itself.
Right.
Well,
For the Kabbalists.
I wouldn't say that's traditional. Traditional is that the entire creation is God.
Right. I'd be careful with tradition, right? Because their tradition is that God is a creator. But what that means, a creator, and how does that, there's a whole spectrum of thought on what tradition is. But there is no tradition.
I'm referring to, I guess I can't use the word traditional, I don't know what to use anymore. But biblical thought, non-Kabbalistic thought, is that God is responsible, directly or indirectly, for all of creation.
But okay, but then what does that mean? And there is no tradition. I mean, right, if you open up the medieval commentators, you're going to get a whole, you know, range of thoughts on it. But anyway, it's fascinating, but there isn't a traditional way of seeing it. So you're pretty close. Like, on the one hand, if you're in this mode that to really understand Kabbalah, you really need to have some Neoplatonic background, this idea that everything unfolds, everything emanates from the source. That's how anything is created. And so once you say that there's something within this Neoplatonic system that doesn't have an aspect of God in it, then that would be another deity, and then you have dualized. But on the other hand, if you say that everything is God, then that's pantheism, right? That's Spinoza. That's heresy. That's not. So he doesn't want to say that either. So what is he saying?
The essence of divine in everything, but not the divine itself.
Right. So that's the idea here, that it's this model of emanation, and that there is some aspect of God in everything, even though everything is not God. There's divinity within everything, even within the stone. And what's interesting here is the Kabbalists are very much criticized by non-Kabbalistic rabbis, by philosophers, by Jewish philosophers, as having dualized, not so much in this sense, but having dualized God, that there is an Ein Sof and the Sefirot. He's worried in general that this idea of emanation will create this notion of dualism. Let's just read this another piece. I just want to give you a sense of this, because I also want to talk a little bit about the sphero. Before anything emanated, Barbara. Your name?
Eddie. Before anything emanated, it was only Ein Sof. Ein Sof was all that existed. Similarly, after it brought into being that which exists, there was nothing but it. You cannot find anything that exists apart from it. There is nothing that is not pervaded by the power of divinity. If there were, Ein Sof would be limited, subject to duality, God forbid. Rather, God is everything that exists, though everything that exists is not God. It is present in everything, and everything comes into being from it. Nothing is devoid of its divinity. Everything is within it. It is within everything and outside of everything. There is nothing but it.
This sounds like you're a pantheism, no?
It's close. And by the way, Cordovero is closer to pantheism than he's not a pantheist, but he's closer. And some Kabbalists accuse Cordovero of being a pantheist. And by the way, some of this sounds close to Hasidic teachings to you, right? The Hasidic notion that God is to be found in nature, right? God is to be found in the material. The Hasidim were very much influenced by Cordoverian Kabbalah, so it's not completely coincidental. Again, not all Kabbalists would go this far in their conception of the emanation of the Ein Sof and then ultimately the creation of the world, but they will go this far in their discussion of the Ein Sof and the Sefirot. So I just wanted you to be aware of this issue of duality. Why don't we quickly, again, just to give you a taste, and we're doing a bit of a survey, why don't we look at the text that we started to look at last time, because now we're not going to be talking about duality in terms of the Ein Sof and the world, but we'll talk talking about duality in terms of the Ein Sof and the Sefirot. So in the beginning, the page right before the page we're at. In the beginning, Ein Sof. Why don't I get one of you back? Moses Cordovero Parag Deis Rimanim, in the beginning.
Yes. Water, light, and colors?
Water, light, and
colors. Water, light, and colors.
In the beginning, Ein Sof emanated ten Sefirot, which are of its essence, united with it. It and they are entirely one. There is no change or division in the emanating that would justify saying it is divided into parts in these various Sefirot. Division and change do not apply to it, only to the external Sefirot.
Okay, so we start to talk about this last time, but now hopefully you have more of a grasp of these concepts. So what is he talking about here? So here's also talking about dualism, right? God forbid. But what are the issues that he's trying to...
Because there are 10 parts. You have to make sure that people understand those 10 parts aren't 10 gods or 10...
Okay, I mean, that's true. And by the way, that's going to be another problem the Kabbalists are going to encounter, right? The allegation that this is polytheism, right? Forget about dualism. You have 10 parts, right?
I think by saying it's...
But he's not even saying that yet. His first he's...
And they are entirely one.
Right, it and thee. So the first issue that he is defending is the notion that there are the Sefirot and the Ein Sof. So Ein Sof emanates the Sefirot, and we'll talk about it, but they're part of its essence. And by the way, that's very important. For the Kabbalists, the Ein Sof, the Sefirot, as I mentioned last time, are God. Right? So they're entirely united. That's why this is monotheism. So there is no change or division in the emanator that would justify saying that it is divided into parts in these various Sefirot. Division and change do not apply only to the external Sefirot. What is he saying there? By the way, there is something paradoxical about all of this. That moment, that initial moment when the infinite moves and becomes finite is going to create some kind of paradox. But so he's dealing with that a little bit here. Division and change do not apply to it, only to the external spheros.
What are the external spheros?
Well, for what about division and change do not apply to it? What is he referring to there? What's the it?
God.
The Ein Sof.
You're right, the Ein Sof, right? This is the part of God that we mentioned at the beginning. It's transcendent, doesn't change, is perfect. It's not the part of God that's provident. And by the way, here, the Kabbalists are also, as I think I mentioned last time, they're solving a problem that the philosophers had. Because, and here I'm referring to the medieval Jewish philosophers, someone like Maimonides. Mm-hmm. Because one basic tenet, right, is that God is perfect, God doesn't change. God, well, God is perfect, which by which would imply that God doesn't change, right? If something is perfect, it's the same at point X and point X plus one. If something changes, that has to do, right, with some kind of deficiency, with some kind of lack of knowledge, with some kind of evolution, and so that might take away from God's perfection. So that's a problem that the medieval philosophers had to deal with, because if you're a traditional, right, Jew, at some point you're going to have to say something changed, right? God willed to create a world. Something was non-existent and then it existed, so something in God had to have changed. There is an element of time, something. So the Kabbalists solve that problem by saying that issue does not take place within the Ein Sof. Nothing in the Ein Sof changes. The Ein Sof does not actively take part in creation and providence and anything that changes. The only thing Ein Sof does is it births the Sphira. Okay. To help you conceive this, because the Cordovero realizes we're going to need help. To help you conceive this, yes.
You didn't answer the question as to what the external spheros are. That was the 10 spheros?
Those are the 10 spheros. Again, here, because of the lack of time, I am, despite what I said at the beginning of this course, that there are different streams within Kabbalah, I'm trying very much to give you the basics and tell you what is common to all of the Kabbalists. So what's common to all of the Kabbalists is the notion that there's the Ein Sof and the spherot. All Kabbalists believe that the spherot are divine. There is a range of opinion within Kabbalistic thought as to what is the nature of the spherot. Some say that they're part of God's essence, and some say they're the vessels for God's essence. So Cordovero thinks of them more as vessels, so that's why he calls them external. But again, I'm not going to get into that issue right now. Yes?
Could we equate the Ein Sof with the Creator and then the spherot with the creation?
Certainly not. Certainly not. The spherot are God, and the Ein Sof is the part of God that has nothing to do with the world. The Kabbalists, in fact, if you want to know how radical the Kabbalists are, most Kabbalists think that there is no mention of the Ein Sof in the entire Torah. All the descriptions of God found in the Torah are referring to the spherot. Again, for the reasons that I mentioned at the beginning, right? We can't say anything. Language can't capture the Ein Sof. Human beings have no way of accessing the Ein Sof. The only way one can access the Ein Sof is through the revealed part of God, which is the Sphirot. To help you conceive this, we need some help here.
To help you conceive this, imagine water flowing through vessels of different colors, white, red, green, and so forth. As the water spreads through those vessels, it appears to change into the colors of the vessels, although the water is devoid of all color. The change in color does not affect the water itself, just our perception of the water. So it is with the sephirot. They are vessels, known, for example, as chesed, gemurah, and tiferet, each colored according to its function, white, red, and green, respectively, while the light of the emanator, their essence, is the water having no color at all. This essence does not change. It only appears to change as it flows through the vessels.
Okay, again, there's a very rich text, and I'm giving you the text to take home so you can take them, you can read them, and there's a lot to get here. But we're going to focus primarily on the theme that we've been discussing. What is he saying here about the relationship between the Ein Sof and the Sphirot? Or what especially is he saying about the Ein Sof?
No end.
Well, we've said that before. What do we...
Well, non-recognizable, non-perceivable in any way. And through the vessels, however, the vessels can impose some sort of an artificial perceptibility that we can then make distinctions. Although,
okay, I don't know if I would say artificial.
Because it's not the Ein Sof per se. It's only something which is artificially, so to speak, engrafted upon the Ein Sof, so that it makes...
Right, except that even for Cordovero, the spherot, or the vessel, are divine. So they're part of... What's his main point here? What is he have? Why the water and the colors?
So your perception is changing, but it's not.
right? The Ein Sof, and not only our perception, right? The Sfirot are changing. The Sfirot contain God, reveal God. They do both two things, by the way, the Sfirot. They both conceal God, right? And they also reveal aspects of God. We would have no, we wouldn't be able to see the water at all were it not for the Sfirot. But the Ein Sof doesn't change. I mean, that's the main point here, right? Even though we perceive the Ein Sof as changing, we perceive God's actions in the world as changing, Ein Sof is not changing. But the Sfirot are changing. Or the Sfirot do have characteristics that allow us to identify
so the,
them.
The colored vessels are the Sfirot and the water.
The colored vessels. So that's one
and
point.
The water is the,
right. So that's one thing that he's trying to get at through this imagery. The one, he's trying to show us that the Ein Sof doesn't change, even though we might perceive it as changing. Right, so we might experience judgment in the world, we might experience mercy in the world, and it seems like a different part of God or a different God, but it's not, right?
What's the difference between the attributes of God and the Ein Sof?
The Ein Sof is the...
Not the Ein Sof, the Sfirot.
The Sfirot are God. They're not attributes of God. The way I defined it the first time is an attribute is something you could take away, right? So you're a woman with blonde hair or with a black sweater, but if you're not wearing a black sweater, you're still you. Something that's part of your essence. The Sfirot are part of God's essence.
Is the 13 attributes part of God's essence?
No, no, be careful. By the way, here you have to be very careful. The Kabbalists use biblical language. So they're right, and that goes back to the question someone asked me about the term Midot Sfirot. It isn't synonymous with the 13, right? We know there are 13 attributes in the that describe God in the Torah. Those are not synonymous with the 10 Sfirot, even though the Kabbalists, these Sfirot are God. These are the parts of God that interact with the world, that have created, according to Kabbalists, that have created the world, that dispense judgment. This is when one prays, this is the part of God that interacts with the world. So the main point that Cordovero is trying to relate through this imagery is, one, again, that the Ein Sof doesn't change, and two, what's the other point? The point that you actually mentioned before. That this isn't polytheism. That it might look to the outside observer as if there are 10 different colored vessels, but really they're all given their life force by the same part of God, by the Ein Sof. And that's very important for the Kabbalists, and here we'll see this in the second imagery again. So better...
In this imagery, the water is what? God.
The water is the Ein Sof.
It's the Ein Sof.
Finish?
Yes.
Better yet, imagine a ray of sunlight shining through a stained glass window of 10 different colors. The sunlight produces no color at all, but appears to change hue as it passes through the different colors of the glass. Colored light radiates through the window. The light has not essentially changed, though so it seems to the viewer. Just so with the Sfirot. The light that clothes itself in the vessels of the Sfirot is the essence, like the ray of sunlight. That essence does not change color at all, neither judgment nor compassion, neither right nor left. Yet by emanating through the Sfirot, the variegated stained glass, judgment or compassion prevails.
So he, yeah. What's he adding here? Why does he think this is better yet?
Better because the sunlight is the source of the light. In the first one, you need light. The water is not doing anything in the first one. You still can't see the water because you need light. In the first one, you're actually seeing light being reflected through the water and the stained glass.
Oh, you're saying that's, okay, that's a nice. So here it's a purer model. You just have the light and the stained glass. Why else does he like?
Because it doesn't contain. It does not, it's not a container, so to speak. In the first imagery, he's looking at the emanations as vessels which contain.
Right.
Which somehow is an uncomfortable image,
of containment. I think maybe he's a little uncomfortable with that, whereas here...
Even though here it's also, I mean, if you think of light coming through stained glass, it's veiled, right? It's not, you're not getting...
But it's not contained, it's not bound up.
Right, right. And there could be more mixing. Yeah. Which he does say, right, that you have judgment and compassion, and we know, right, in the world sometimes they're mixed. So this image allows for that, right? There could be, it's not just judgment, it's not just grace.
Also,
it's
the colors are unlimited. Sometimes when you look at colors, it's right. Like a red, the other ones are just limited to the colors. This is like a more right. Than a red.
Right. And the Kabbalists also often, you'll see, like the imagery of light. And one reason for this is light, unlike water, right, even though it shines forth, the original source isn't depleted. So that works nicely for the Ein Sof, right? Even though the light is shining forth, the Ein Sof is still infinite. The Ein Sof is still perfect. Right? Water, right, if it flows, then the original source is depleted. So that's why, right, the Zohar, the Book of Splendor, the Bahir, the Book of the Bright Light, another classic work of Kabbalah, Jikatilia, Sha'are Orah, the Gates of Light. So the Kabbalists often use that. Also, again, we're not going to have time for this, but the Kabbalists see the Sefirot and the Godhead as a dynamic system. It's not static. So right now we're going to look at the diagram, and right, and it's on a page of paper, and it's two-dimensional. It seems very static. But for the Kabbalists, these Sefirot are dynamic. They link with one another. They move back and forth, and therefore the Kabbalists like the imagery of light, right? Light that shines back, forth, and back. So here, so I just also want you to be aware, and the main reason I brought you this text, other than the fact that it's beautiful, is to give you a taste of the fact that the Kabbalists are aware of the issues that some of these ideas are close to dualism, close to polytheism, and they're very much. They're very sensitive to point out where, in fact, how this isn't polytheism and how it isn't dualism. Okay, so now David asks for a discussion of the Sefirot, and I will do that. Here one has to be careful. Again, Kabbalah is very powerful. The Kabbalists, as we'll see, were very subtle in their use of language and imagery. So one has to be careful. First of all, they use biblical language. They use Talmudic and rabbinic images. So now you have to be careful. Once you learn about these images, don't go back and start reading everything in the Bible or everything in the Talmud and say, aha, it's all there, right? Because the Kabbalists also are playing with those images. So it's a subtle way to think about it. So just let me speak for 2 minutes about the Sefirot in general, even though we've basically said this. According to the Kabbalists, there is this moment, and again, there's going to be a paradox any day where you slice it, where the infinite, and there are different ways of understanding it, either because of mercy, transitions into a part of itself that is finite, and that allows for the creation of the world eventually, which is finite. That allows for human beings to interact with God because they can only understand, right? We can only understand things that are finite, things that have limit. Other people say that this actually was due to God's acts of judgment, that this is something that was restrictive, that God went from being infinite into a part of God that has limitations and restrictions.
Some tools.
Not, this is even pre-tzimtzum. Those ideas also then are translated into tzimtzum. Tzimtzum is primarily found in Lurianic Kabbalah, which is in the 15th century, and I'm giving you ideas which are found in all types of Kabbalah, so we'll see these ideas in the Zohar. So even before tzimtzum, but there's this moment where the infinite God births, emanates, unfolds, whatever imagery works for you, into the finite Sefirot. The Sefirot, as I said, are often referred to as crowns, and the idea is that they are crowns of the Ein Sof, right? So we never get to see the Ein Sof, right? That's a nice image, but you only get to see the crown of the Ein Sof. They're often referred to as garments. Again, garments of the Ein Sof, and just as garments, right, they conceal the body, but they reveal the person, right? The first thing you notice about a person, you encounter, right, their clothes. So that the garments are the revealed part of God that again reveal and conceal. we began to speak about this last time, but let's do this a little bit more systematically, and hopefully we'll get, this time around, we'll get a chance to look at the piece in the Zohar. Again, these ideas are very hard, and if you're encountering them for the first time, I know I'm giving you a lot. But again, I can refer you to a lot of books to go back to and read. And this is just the taste of basic Kabbalistic ideas. Yes.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. So is the
concept, remind me your name.
Gabe. So is their concept to break God down into tangible concepts? Is that the
no, I mean,
the idea of the structure?
For a Kabbalist, right, this is the truth. This is God.
They believe in the infinite.
No, they believe in both aspects of God, right? To God.
Because God is both finite and infinite, yes. Simultaneous. So he might have 10 finite compartments, while at the same time he's completely infinite on each level, on Chokhmah, on Chesed, on Bina, he's infinite. Or no,
the notion is, no, well, the way the Kabbalists, again, there are various ways of speaking about this. We can't say too much about the answer, right? That's the Kabbalistic understanding of, but the way that sort of everything is in potential is found in the Ein Sof. You could sort of think of like stem cells, right? Everything is there in potential within the Ein Sof, and then the Ein Sof births this finite aspect of itself, which are the spherot, which eventually allows for the emanation of the entire universe.
So
which is limited,
so them,
and finite, and something that is measurable.
Okay, so for them, an expertise and a complete grasp of one of the spherot
is idolatry.
What?
No, I said that to be shocking. It's separation. That is something one has to be careful. That is something one has to be careful about. The Kabbalists emphasize that one can't focus too much on any one sphera. For that reason, all these 10 are one. And these 10 are also one with the Ein Sof. This is monotheism.
It's a catch-22. If you're saying that each element is finite, so if I can...
No, but finite... Why don't you wait till I describe...
Okay.
It's not a unit unto itself, right? This is a system that emanates. And it emanates one from the other. And maybe a way of thinking about this is that especially within the lower spherot, right, there are elements of all the higher spherot, right? So the child, right, has genes from the parents, right? It's not a complete break, so you'll see. So let's start with the first sphera. So this is that first move when God moves from being infinite to something finite. And if something is bothering you here, that makes sense, because, again, this is paradoxical. But once you take on faith that first moment of paradox, the whole system does work. The Kabbalists are rather consistent. So Keter is that very first moment of emanation, that very first moment of differentiation. If you're looking at the map, Keter is the highest sphera. It's called crown. And even the name Keter gives you a sense of the dual function of this sphera. Keter is the crown to the Ein Sof, right? And I told you that all of the spherot are referred to as crown. Keter is also the crown to all the other spherot. So Keter has this dual function. And in fact, some Kabbalists like to speak of Keter as having two aspects. It has the upper aspect that is almost a part of the Ein Sof. And then it has this lower aspect, which is the beginning of the spherot. Keter is also called divine will, and this has to do with the issue that I mentioned before, that there is no will within the Ein Sof, because will implies change, right? You will something at one point and you don't will it at another, so you can't have that. You can't have change in the Ein Sof. The Ein Sof is perfect, is unchanging. So the first moment of will, and that also makes sense, because that would lead to a system of emanation. I could really confuse you, but I won't do it yet. That first moment of will is Keter. So Keter is also referred to as divine will. I'll have some fun. The Kabbalah works on two levels. Kabbalah, again, if I'm losing you, then don't worry about this point, because it's rather subtle. Kabbalah works on the level that it's it has content. It's a system of understanding God. Kabbalah is also a hermeneutic. It's also a way of reading the Torah. A hermeneutic, a way of doing exegesis, a way of reading the Torah. And so the Kabbalists read, and the only reason why I'm telling you this is because we're talking about the creation of the Sefirot. Many Kabbalists read the story of creation in Genesis as not being the creation of the world, but as being this creation of the Sefirot. So, I just was going to throw that out there. Okay, so Keter is often referred to because we were talking about creation. Keter is often referred to as divine will. It's also, as I said, referred to as Keter Elyon, the highest crown. And here's an interesting name of Keter that, by the way, Hasidim liked very much later on. Keter is also referred to as Ayin, right? The Kabbalists understood the paradox. Is also referred to as nothing. Because even though, right, Keter is the highest Sefirah, it's so close to the Ein Sof that you can almost say nothing about it in some ways. And so the Keter is also referred to as Ayin. It's also sometimes referred to as the source of all being. So the name for God found in the Bible, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, is often associated, I will be that which I will be, is often associated with Keter, because Keter is the beginning of being. Any questions, or this isn't a shy group, if you have questions, you ask. Okay. The next Sefira after Keter is Chokhmah. So these emanate. So Keter births, maybe that's helping you a little bit. These are connected, and they're not only connected, one flows from the other. So Keter births Chokhmah. Chokhmah, as you see, is, according to Kabbalists, on the right side. Now Keter, as I said, is so far removed, is so close to the Ein Sof, the Kabbalists believe you can hardly say anything about it. And even in terms of creation of the world, right, this is God. Even in terms of creation, Keter is too lofty to even speak about the beginning of creation occurring within Keter. The Kabbalists believe that the first idea of creation occurs in Chokhmah, in wisdom. Chokhmah is also often referred to as the beginning. Right, because it's the beginning, it's the first idea of creation. It's also often referred to as a point, because all of creation eventually will emanate out of this first idea, out of this point. And again, if this all hasn't been radical enough for you, the Kabbalists they also associate genders with the Sefirot. So Chokhmah is often seen as being the upper male, the upper father. And by the way, the reason why I'm telling you all of these symbols, and the reason why this is an important introduction, it both conveys the Kabbalist understanding of the Sefirot. And as I said, Kabbalah also functions as a hermeneutic. So let's say if you ever want to open up a Zohar, I was hoping we'd have time tonight, we'll see. The Kabbalists assume that you know all of these symbols and that you know all of these images. They are not going to guide you through this, right? These are the ABCs. This is something that one learns, you know, very early on. And then they'll just talk about the point, or they'll talk about Reshit, or they'll talk about the Upper Father or Keter Elyon, and you're supposed to know. So these symbols also are important in terms of just being able to read basic Kabbalistic texts. Yes.
Are these words that are associated with these Sefirot, perfect? Like, it is Keter. Yeah. There is no other word for it.
No, and in fact,
is this just one version of the way this is?
Yeah, no. Well, these labels are pretty basic, and so you find them in most Kabbalistic schools, and that's why I gave them to you. But in fact, the Kabbalists use a wide range of symbols to discuss each of the Sefirot, and especially the closer we get to our world, the Kabbalists believe that one can speak more about the lower sirot, right? Keter is so lofty that you can't really say too much about Keter, just as one can't say too much about the Ein Sof. So Keter isn't discussed so much. By the time you get to the Shekhinah, right, the Shekhinah is the sphira that has the most to do with the world. You have hundreds, if not thousands, of symbols associated with the Shekhinah. And part of that has to do with the rich nature of these symbol of the each of these spherot, and so you can't pin it down to one.
The word Shekhinah.
Right.
For that.
Right. No. Shekhinah. No. No, because you have Shekhinah, and then you'll have Malchut, and then you'll have 100 other symbols. And the Kabbalists also were aware of the limitations of just defining it by one term. So, but it's a very good question. Okay. I just want to get through the spherot, so let's move on. Chokhmah births Binah, and Binah is already a complicated sphira. Binah is, as I said, Chokhmah is the beginning, the idea of creation, but it's still undifferentiated, right? It's still a point. The Kabbalists say that it's in Binah that the idea of creation becomes crystallized, becomes clearer. Binah is often portrayed as sort of having the blueprint for the entire creation, and especially the emanation of the rest of the spheros. And often the symbol of the womb is associated with the spherah, this idea that all the other spherot and eventually creation is already contained, is already mapped out, planned out within Binah. And that imagery isn't, again, completely coincidental. Just as Chokhmah is portrayed as the upper father, Binah is portrayed as the upper mother that then gives birth to the seven lower spherot, as it were. Binah is also associated in certain Kabbalistic systems with the world to come. Okay, now what's interesting is, again, remember, we are going from the most lofty spherot that are closest to the Ein Sof to the spherot that have more to do with, that interact more with the world. So the Kabbalists actually distinguish between the three upper spherot that are so close to the Ein Sof that one can't speak much about them, and the seven lower spherot. So, of course, all ten are one and they're a unit. But on the other hand, and that maybe answers your question, if you open up the Zohar, if you open up the Eitz Chaim, Luria's text, you'll find more discussion of the seven lower spherot, because those are the spherot that are deemed more perceivable for human beings. And also, some of the symbols associated with this spherot make use of these seven. Some of you might be aware of the idea of the Ushpizim, right? The seven guests on the holiday of Sukkot. Each of these Ushpizim is associated with one of the lower seven spherot. The seven spherot are often referred to as the 7 days of the week, and the Shekhinah being the Sabbath. So again, these are all symbols, but I'm sort of giving you a little bit of a key to read Kabbalistic texts. Yes.
Anything have to do with balancing, like one on the other side?
Excellent. Right now I'm just talking about the individual spherot. The Kabbalists also have schematizations for the spherot, and one of the central schematizations is the lines. So there's a notion that everything on the right, well, actually, it's a perfect segue, so I wasn't going to do this, but I'll do it. Let's move to 4, 5, and 6, okay. And then I'll show you how it works. So the next sphere after, the next sphera after Binah is Chesed. Yeah, we go Keter, Chokhmah, Binah, Chesed, Din, Tiferet. And now Chesed is an interesting sphera. By the way, these ideas already became more disseminated and became more popular in Judaism. So some of these ideas might sound familiar to you and you might not be exactly sure where, and that's because they're found in the Musar literature and they've crept into the sermons, various sermons. So again, these ideas become rather, even though this might seem very daring and out there, these ideas become popular, especially because of the influence of the Kabbalists in Tzfat. So the next sphira is Chesed. Chesed means, by the way, cross out mercy. I don't like that translation, and I'll explain why in a second. Chesed means grace, love, And so, right, chesed seems like a good sphira, but the problem with chesed is that if it's too much love, if it's not in balance, if it's not checked, it's the kind of love that could be overpowering, right? So you could sort of think of the love that smothers, right? It's too much. And so the Kabbalists very much have this sense that chesed, although chesed is a great thing, right? It's God's grace, right? It's God's, I don't want to use mercy, but you'll see why, but it's God's kindness. It has to be in check. And the sphira that holds it in check is the sphira that's parallel to it, is Deen. Deen is a very complicated sphira. Deen is the fifth sphira. So I've already given you some clue of what the positive function of Deen is. Deen, the positive function of Deen is that it holds chesed in balance, it restricts, right? It gives some kind of limit to this overpowering love, that if it weren't balanced by some kind of limit, by some kind of justice, it would overbear everything else. Deen also allows for there to be reward and punishment in the world, right? For there to be justice, right? Because if there would only be God's mercy, if there would only be God's kindness, right, then everyone would get it, whether you're good or bad. So Deen provides for justice. It provides for punishment. But Deen, and here again, this is where the Kabbalists have a few incredibly daring notions, and I've thrown out some of them, and here is one of them. The Kabbalists also believe that Deen is the beginning or is the seed of evil. So this is very daring, right? This is with the question of where, the root of evil, right? Where does evil come from? If God is all good, right? How is there evil in the world? Well, for the Kabbalists, there's already evil within God, or the root of evil. I have to be careful. There's the root of evil. Just as if chesed is not in balance, so too deen, if it's not in balance, becomes the root of evil. Now, this is all, speaking about the different lines, this is all held in check by the middle sphira. The middle sphira is also a very important sphira in Kabbalistic literature. This middle sphira is Tiferet, beauty, and I would put mercy here, because the Kabbalists often call Tiferet Rachamim. And the reason it's referred to as Rachamim is it's the sphira that holds everything in balance, especially the left and right, and that's an act of mercy. Tiferet is also, I think you mentioned the Kodesh Brichu, the Holy One, Blessed Be He, that name for God, we'll get to the rest of that equation soon, but God, the name of God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is often associated in Kabbalistic literature with this sixth sphira. The sixth sphira is very important for the Kabbalists, and you could sort of see why structurally. Right, it's connected, it's the center, it's the pillar. In the Zoharic text that I prepared for you, it's the trunk of the tree. It holds everything together. Then the next two sphirot somehow don't have so much imagery associated with them. It's Netzach. They both have images of monarchy associated with them. Netzach is the divine, the merciful monarch, is the monarch that is kind to his subjects. Hod is the more regal, the more distant monarch. And again, as I said, the Kabbalists are very daring, so we've seen many daring, but we've seen in our discussion of the imagery their discussion of the root of evil within the Sefirot. Another incredibly daring aspect of Kabbalah, and that's one of the reasons I said that Kabbalah was often restricted to people who were older, people who were married, is the sexual symbolism. So here it comes. The ninth sphira is Yesod. Yesod is often associated with the phallus, and the idea is that all of the energies of all the other sphirot are channeled through Yesod. Yesod is also often associated with the tzaddik, with the righteous one. It's another, and here the Kabbalists are playing with the verse, tzaddik yesod olam, so you have both tzaddik and yesod. It's also often associated, and here you see how sort of smart the Kabbalists are and how they play with all of these symbols simultaneously. It's also often associated with Joseph, with Yosef, right? Because Yosef is often called Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous One, and one of the reasons why he's deemed to be righteous is because of his quality of sexual restraint, right? He refused the advances of Potiphar's wife, and again, so that is, all of this comes together in the Sefirah of Yesod. And then we come to perhaps the Sefirah that the most ink is spilled about. And that's the last Sefirah. That's the Sefirah of Shekhinah, Malchut. Already has two names from the get-go. I don't even know where to begin with Shekhinah, Malchut. You could see, by the way, Kabbalah also works very much visually. The Kabbalists sort of imagine that anyone reading their text has these diagrams in their head. When you look at this diagram, and now that you know a little bit about the Sefirah, what would you associate? What characteristics would you associate with
human
the Shekhinah?
I'm saying it's a human body. Don't you think it has a look of the body?
Okay, so all of the Sefirah, the woman before asked about what about the different sides, the right, left, and the center, and that's one schematization. Another incredibly daring schematization is all of the Sefirot as the human body, and the Kabbalists take the verse in the Bible that God is created in man's image very seriously, right? For them, that's not just the spirit. Of course, one has to be careful here, right? This isn't anthropomorphic, right? This is, again, a spiritual notion, but different parts of the body are very much associated with different parts of, with different spheros. So I've said that a little bit with the Yesod. And the same is true also, now that we're going with the sexual symbolism, the same is also true of the Shekhinah, is often associated with female genitalia, and I'll explain why in a second. What else? But forget about it. I'm just talking about Shekhinah. What would you say about the Shekhinah?
Closest to Earth.
Okay, so first of all, closest to the universe, and then closest to man. And so the Shekhinah is interesting in that the function, Shekhinah is often associated with the feminine aspect of God. The Shekhinah, on the one hand, is the lowest in terms of her position with the rest of the Sefirot, but if you imagine sort of right human beings here, the Shekhinah is the aspect of God that human beings interact with. And that's why the term Shekhinah, right, means providence, right? It's a term, of course, found in the Bible. So be careful now every time you see the term Shekhinah, unless you want to read it as a Kabbalist word. You don't have to say, aha, that's the female aspect of God, but for the Kabbalist it often is. But the Shekhinah is the part of God that is providence, most providence. And that's why the Shekhinah has the name of king. Right, the Shekhinah dispenses justice. She administers punishment and reward.
She doesn't bring the two together, the top and the bottom.
Okay, excellent. The Kabbalists often speak about that, right? Because the Kabbalists often stress that this is all a unity. I remember the first time I taught this, I got a little depressed. So I taught this at Brown, and an undergrad who had never seen any of this material, he said, well, what do you make of the fact that Keter is the highest Sefirah, right, the crown, and Malchut is the lowest Sefirah? I was like, wow, I've been thinking about this material, and I thought about it today. But yes, right, the Kabbalists very much want to stress that the highest Sefirah is connected with the lowest. These are 10 that are one. And there are other parallels between the Shekhinah and Keter, right? Just as I said, the Keter is in this liminal position, that Keter in some ways is unknowable, like the Ein Sof, and in other ways it's the beginning of the revealed aspect of God. So too the Shekhinah plays that function. On the one hand, the Shekhinah is God, is part of the Sefirot. On the other hand, the Shekhinah is the part of God that is most involved with the affairs of human beings, and is the one that empathizes most with the affairs of human beings. The Shekhinah is often depicted as the mother for those reasons. The Shekhinah is often depicted in various roles that portray her as a female, so as a queen, as a princess, as a bride, as you know, right, the Friday night liturgy was created by Kabbalists, so you might have to rethink what the poem, right, L'chadodi, come my beloved, come the bride, all of that. They're invoking all of these images in those poems. The Shechina, and again, in the beginning, feminists were very excited about the Kabbalistic understanding of the Godhead, because all of a sudden, right, all the prayers and everything, and all the language in the Bible is masculine in the description of God. Suddenly you have a portrayal of God that incorporates both male and female aspects of God. So this was very exciting, and as some of you might know, right, certain Rosh Chodesh, women's Rosh Chodesh groups do special programs that center around the Shekhinah, and again, the story is more complicated, because the Shekhinah, yes, she's the highest sphira, and sort of has a lot of importance in vis-a-vis the world, but she's also the lowest sphira within the system of the sphirot. And in many ways, right, I said Yesod is the phallus, the energy of all the other sphirot is channeled through Yesod, and it goes to the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah, in many ways, is a very passive sphira, and she really absorbs all of the characteristics of the other sphirot. And so that's why the Shekhinah has the richest array of symbols associated with her, because she reflects, she's often depicted as the moon. She reflects the, again, with the, obviously the other image, of the, she reflects the characteristics and the attributes of a lot of the other sphirot. And I remember this also, when, I think when you first hear about the Shekhinah, you think of the Shekhinah as the provident mother, as sort of the soft female, but the Kabbalists don't see it that way. Right, the Kabbalist, the Shekhinah contains aspects of all the sphirot, both of the right side, both of grace, and of the left side, and of justice, and of judgment. And so the Shekhinah has both. And that's why she can be providence, and that's why she can administer both reward and punishment. You had a question?
You said the seven reflect the 7 days of the week and whatever, but also the number 10 is like a very important number. 10 is a minyan, and 10, you know, it's right. Like you say that 10 has anything to do with...
Right, and the Kabbalists speak about, right, how 10 is a perfect number and how... But I think it boils down to the fact that this is an oral tradition. There's no good answer, just as there's no good answer why are these called sphirot. There's no good answer why 10 and not 11, but that is the tradition. Oh, I actually wanted to mention that some Kabbalists think that Keter, which is about the number 10, and showing you how what a central notion is for all Kabbalists, that they're 10 sphirot, that's a given. Some Kabbalists say that Keter is such a lofty part of God that it shouldn't even be considered a sphira. But then you have a problem, right? Then you have 9 sphirot, and everyone has a tradition that there are 10. So what some people do, and you could perhaps write this in if you want to, some people have a sphira that's sort of in the middle of Chokhman Binah, which is called Da'at. And again, it's not completely coincidental, right? The acronym of those three would be Chabad, Chokhmah Binah Da'at. And again, right, Chabad and Chassidim are very much steeped in Kabbalistic traditions. So that's all there. That also, of course, also has the sexual connotations, right? So, and we know that this is the upper mother and the upper father. So that this is the union that produces all of the other sephirot. Okay, I hope I haven't shocked you too much. I don't think we're going to get to text, but before I take your question, I just want to say one other very daring aspect of Kabbalah that I think gets short shrift. People speak about the sphirot because it's sort of an exciting conceptual way to think about God. If you ask me to say what are the main concepts of Kabbalah, I'd say one concept is the concept of the sphirot, and obviously related to the idea of the sphirot is the notion of the Ein Sof, which we spent the beginning of this lecture talking about. Another central component that we haven't spoken about at all is the role of man vis-a-vis this conception of God. Right? I've said that if Chesed would be too powerful, that wouldn't be good. If Deen is too powerful, that wouldn't be good. But what determines, right, this this balance. And another important goal for the Kabbalist is to ensure the unity of these symbols. Sometimes they become distant from one another, and that's where the sexual symbolism plays an important role. The sexual symbolism is within the Godhead, right? So you want to create unity, and that's why the Kabbalists use that imagery. They want to create unity within God. And what determines, oh, by the way, someone threw out before the Kutchabricho and Shlinte, so that also plays into this, right? Kutchabrichu, now you all know this already. Kutchabrichu is which sphira?
Tiferet
is the sixth, is the male aspect. The one of the dominant male parts of the sphirot is Tiferet. And then what's Shchinte?
Shchina.
The tenth sphira, which again is the dominant female aspect. And so what that little, I don't even know what to call it, it's a kavanah, it's an intention that if you open up with your Pesach Haggadot, you might find that before you drink the four cups of wine, before the blessing, there's a little passage that we are doing this in order to unify Kudsh HaBrichu and Shchinte. Well, now you know a little bit about what's going on there, right? You're trying to unify the male and female parts of God through your actions, through your drinking of the wine, through your performance of the commandments. And that leads me to concept number two that I at least want to throw out there, because I'll feel guilty if I sort of introduce Kabbalah and speak about this at all. That's the notion, I'll give you a fancy word, of theurgy. The Kabbalists believe, and here this is very daring, the Kabbalists believe that human actions affect God. So again, I said before, this isn't a static understanding of God. This picture changes, and different parts of God are in the ascendant depending on the acts of man. And again, this is a very different conception of God than certainly than the God you maybe when you think about when you read the Bible, right? The God that is all-powerful and punishes at will. This is a God that needs man. This is a God, right? Heschel's book, right? God in Search of Man, or God Who Needs Man. I can't remember the exact title. Heschel is very much steeped in Kabbalistic traditions, right? This is a God that his whole constitution depends on human action. So that's...
And how is he perfect?
I don't know if perfect is the exact... The Eight Sof is perfect in that it's unchanging. The spheros are not, they're dynamic, they're sometimes in a state of unbalance, they're sometimes in a state of dislocate. They're not, I wouldn't say the spheros are perfect. In the, sort of in the ideal state, in the messianic age, they'll be perfect, but right now they're not.
That
I just wanted to comment.
Oh yeah, you had a question a long time ago.
That's not really a question. I just wanted to comment when I look at the ten spheros. It looks like the internet, where all the lines are connecting each other, and each one of the spheros are connected by many different lines, one to the other, mm-hmm. except for the finale of the ten, which seems mm-hmm. to be at the bottom with no connection. So this was like you said, that's the recipient of.
Well, first of all, this should be at least a three-dimensional picture, if not more. And yes, for the Kabbalists, this is all connected. Every unity affects other parts of the Godhead. And yes, so that's why they emphasize time and time again. This is monotheism. This is one unit that's completely interconnected. And some, again, I don't want to complicate it. I sort of gave you very much the basics. But in some Kabbalistic systems, you have within each sphira a system of spheros. Mm. So you have Keter Shebechet, right, within each of the spherot. And by the way, some of you write count the Omer, Sphira to Omer, the 49 days, that's the seven lower ones with the seven lower ones within them. If you go back and look at your art scrolls, Sidur, if you have them, you'll see. So you'll have, right, Keter Shebedin, Tiferet Shebedin. So I'm saying, but the more basic, the larger idea is that they're all connected. Yes.
The last point you made, the theurgized?
Theurgy.
Theurgy?
Yes. By the way, that's sort of, if you want to know sort of what defines a Kabbalistic Kabbalah. Every Kabbalist, they might emphasize this more and they might emphasize this less, but every Kabbalist's understanding of God consists of the Sefirot and the Ein Sof, and every Kabbalist has a conception that human deeds affect God.
Okay, so I'd like to ask a question at that point. So, yes. Therefore, a Kabbalist, a senior member of this misunderstanding, can, in a sense, help you manipulate or further facilitate God's position vis-a-vis you?
Well, here's something interesting. The Kabbalists don't think it's just the Kabbalists who can do that. It's everyone who does it without knowing. When one does good, when one, especially when one performs the commandments, one has a positive effect on God. And when one sins, by the way, that's sort of the secret no one talks about, right? And through sin, one detracts from God. One makes God, one worsens the God situation. That everyone, and that gives a tremendous weight to human deeds and to the performing the commandments and to sin.
But it's true. Do not seem to be part of this.
I'm sorry?
The fundamental aspect of religion, the fundamental performance.
Well, we have to be careful, right? For the Kabbalists, right? So the Kabbalists will say that every act, this is God, and every act affects God.
But the fundamentals of religion don't appear here on this schematic.
Well, God doesn't appear in your schematic either, right? God is
In the other theory of God,
right?
He does. Like,
why?
Putting on my tefillin in the morning,
right,
does not affect chokhmah, chesed, din,
and it does affect God. It does affect the other, sort of the non-philosophical.
Well, if you believe that by following the code of fundamentals, mm-hmm, then you're following God's will, and therefore your prayers will better pierce God if you follow a fundamental.
These are big issues, and there's a whole range. There's not. I mean, I think what's incredibly daring here is, first of all, this conception of God that has aspects that are close to dualism and close to polytheism, that obviously they aren't. And then this notion that human beings affect. By the way, let me be careful here. Human beings, for the Kabbalists, only, by definition, obviously, only affect the Sefirot, right? Nothing affects, right? The Ein Sof doesn't change.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, because Maimonides, I don't think Maimonides would agree that there's any way that human beings...
Oh, this would be completely anathema to, right? Because this, in a way, I don't want to say lessens, because the Kabbalists obviously also think God is the highest... supreme power, but they would, the philosophers would say that this is very much lessening what God is, right? God isn't dependent, God doesn't change
our service
on the basis,
exactly.
Very much on the kayak. When the Kabbalists first came out, people think that they first made their writings. What did people think of that?
Right. Well, that's what we said. It's so interesting. Right. We spoke about this a little bit. Right. What's interesting is that there doesn't seem to be, unlike Maimonides, where there are huge polemics right against Maimonides' writings. Kabbalah is certainly the Zohar. Right. Is very much accepted as one of these sacred texts. Does that mean that most people really understand that, you know, being a Kabbalist or subscribing to Kabbalah means that this is your conception of God? I don't know. But Kabbalah very much was accepted as a sacred tradition.
Was Gileon challenged at his time?
Not so much. Not so much. Not that everyone became, first of all, no one thought it was De Leon, right? Everyone thought it was Shimon Bar Yochai.
Well,
so
he ascribed it to Shimon Bar Yochai, but I thought that there were
significant
rabbis in his generation.
Not significant. There are a few, Isaac of Akko. There are already some people who start to say, perhaps this isn't. But most people think it's Bar Yochai, and therefore it's a sacred authoritative text. Now, again, does that mean that everyone was a Kabbalist or, you know, this was the God they were praying to? I doubt it. But were these books burned? No. And then certainly by the time you get to Tzfat, right, this pervades a very big community. And then from Tzfat onward, a lot of these texts are popularized and become important both in Sephardic and Ashkenazic land. So it's interesting. You would think these are such daring ideas.
It sounds like something like that.
Right. I mean, and the Kabbalists were very, they wanted to restrict this knowledge and, I just wanted to, we're not going to have a chance to read it, but I feel bad. It's not a little piece, it's a long piece. It's a beautiful piece. The Zohar, the conduct of the world through the Sphirot. Can we read one paragraph so you get a taste of the Zohar? But then I can take this. So this is, it's 258 at the top. I feel like I made all these photocopies. You might as well get a taste. Then, is this your first time reading the Zohar?
Yeah.
Okay, I won't ask if anyone is under 40 or married or
we can.
Okay, so let me just, I'll tell you for 2 seconds what this is. This is Tikkuni HaZohar. This is actually emendations to the Zohar. If you open up the Zohar is a five volume work, so this would be the fourth volume. And what's going on here, let me just quickly tell you what this is. There's a scholar, after you finish reading Sholem, I recommend another beautiful work, and it has recently been translated to English, are the writings of Isaiah Tishbe, who was a professor of Kabbalah at the Hebrew University. He never got a post in Kabbalah at the Hebrew University, but that tells you more about the politics of academia than anything about Tishbe's scholarship. And Tishbe wrote a lot and wrote many great works about Kabbalah, but the reason why I'm speaking about Tishbe right now is one of Tishbe's major contributions is he wrote a work in Hebrew called Mishnat HaZohar, The Wisdom of the Zohar, which has recently been translated, so we're lucky. And what he did in that work was the Zohar is primarily, the first three volumes of the Zohar are a midrash, are a commentary on the Torah. And so, while very beautiful, they're also associative, they're written in the style of the Talmud, discursive, moves from one thing to another. So if you wanted to, let's say I was giving this lecture and I wanted to say, well, what does the Zohar have to say about the Sefirot or the Ein Sof, it would be almost impossible to find, right? Imagine doing that for Rashi, right? Because the Zohar is a commentary on the Torah. So what Tishbe did was went through the Zohar and took out passages pertaining to various themes and created this work called the Wisdom of the Zohar. So if you're a student of the Zohar, a beginner, this is a very helpful work. And he also wrote beautiful essays before each of these themes. So if you're interested in evil in the Zohar, there's a whole essay on evil and then all the passages in the Zohar pertaining to evil. So he helped me a little bit for this evening. Okay, and again, we're not going to have too much time, but I want you to get a taste of the poetry of the Zohar. So what's your name?
Gladys.
Why not?
Rabbi Simeon.
Oh, I'm sorry. So this is for the conduct of the world through the Sphirot.
Which one? Oh, the conduct of the world.
Did you all see it?
Yes.
Okay.
Elijah began and said, Master of the world, you are one but not in number. You are the highest of the high, the secret of all secrets. You?
Yes, on the back. We saved some space.
You are altogether beyond the reach of thought. You are
Okay, so by the way, these are some of the same ideas that we saw in Cordovero, but here you get the sense of the different styles, which I mentioned last time, right? That when you speak about Kabbalah, you have Kabbalah that's much more mythic, much more symbolic, poetic, and then you have some Kabbalistic works that are much more, at least in terms of their style, philosophic in their orientation. So Elijah began. This is Elijah. Who's Elijah? Eliyahu Navi. So this is a conversation between Elijah and Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, the alleged author of the Zohar. You are one, but not in number. What would the one be?
Ein Sof.
Good. The Ein Sof. right? So the Ein Sof is one, but to say that the Ein Sof is a number would be to impose something finite, right? We can't even say that Ein Sof is one. Okay, you are the highest of the high, the secrets of the secrets. You are altogether beyond the reach of thought. You are he that produced the 10 tikkunim. So some of you didn't like the word sefirot. You have another term here, tikkunim. But here you have, which are called the 10 sefirot. Okay?
So that through them you might guide the secret worlds that are not revealed and the worlds that are revealed. And through them you are concealed from mankind, and you bind them and unite them.
Okay, so here we have, okay, obviously in a very different style, in a much more poetic style, but we have a lot of the ideas we saw in that Cordovero piece. What's he saying here? Okay, so first of all, you hold everything together, and you are the source that allows the sphero to be one and to be a unit. And what else?
Since you are within, whoever separates...
No, but before that, and before this is an interesting point, so that through then you might guide the secret worlds that are not revealed, right? So through the revealed spheros, right, through this diagram... The Ein Sof can guide the world. The Ein Sof and the Sefirot can guide the world. But they also, as we said, are the garments, the crowns. They also conceal. Okay, we'll end with this next few lines. I just wanted you to have a taste. So since you are within, continue.
Since you are within, whoever separates one of the ten from its fellow is thought of as making a separation in you.
Okay, so here, right, he's not as obvious as Cordovero was in how polemical he's being, right? He's not saying God forbid, but he's the author of the Zohar here, right, or the Zohar is very much saying that one can't separate the Sefirot, and if one separates the Sefirot, right, then we're talking about polytheism, right? So one has to be careful. And then here, and we'll stop here, but just a lot of the schemes that we've talked about, right? These 10 spheros follow the order in which one is long, one short, one intermediate. That's the right, the left, and the center. And then you have the image of the body. So you have a lot of the themes that we've talked about. I would have liked to read it. It's a beautiful piece. But I think we're going to stop here. Hope I've given you a little bit of a taste. It's a lot. Please. And if you have any questions.
I've heard it said that God needs our prayers. Is that Kabbalistic? I find it hard to conceive that God would need our prayers.
Right. Well, the Kabbalists would certainly say that. Other people might also, of course. For the Kabbalists, that's very real, right? It's not only that God needs; it's Chokhmah needs and Bina needs to be in unity. Even though, again, I don't want to paint too sort of simplistic a picture, right? The Kabbalists are will constantly say, as it were, and if you will, and if you can imagine such things on high. I actually gave you, we don't have time here, but if you look at the third page, right, this is by one of the great rabbis, the Note of Yehuda, who in his introduction to his Gemara commentary talks about the symbols of Kabbalah, interestingly enough, in the 18th century. And he says that these symbols are really like the alphabet, right? So it's almost like teaching, right? I just taught you the beginning of a new language. In the beginning, it doesn't mean much, right? Go tell a child that A is A and B is B and C is C. Only eventually, then, they realize that through these symbols, they can read. They can learn truth. So in some ways, this is really just an introduction. And again, Kabbalah is also very much a way of reading the Torah, in order to get at the mystical truth.
Would you say right now, just somebody should come away with learning that this Kabbalah will make you closer to Hashem, closer to God, feel the one who feels closer?
I think the God of the Kabbalists is actually a very, right, a complicated, sophisticated, it's not sort of a God that's easy to comprehend. It's a God that takes a lot of work, and the concept, if we had more time, we'd also talk about Kavanah. Intention is very important for the Kabbalists, and obviously has its own, it's not a simple way of practicing religion.
They view it as a complementary teaching and foundation within the religion,
yeah,
was completely separate.
No.
You'll just learn everything we learn and learn Kabbalah.
You missed my third one.
I did. You got a quick answer, huh?
Yeah, this was very much seen as the dessert. This is something you do after you know the Bible, after you know the Talmud.
And it all works. And it works as one.
Well, for, it's an extra. It's dealing with the divine. It's dealing with, right? You know, the Talmud isn't. I mean, it's dealing with different things.
Thank you.